This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. It's good to have you with us. Now, to understand the present, it's important to revisit the past. On October 7th, 2001, President George W. Bush addressed the American people.
The oppressed people of Afghanistan will know the generosity of America and our allies. As we strike military targets, we will also drop food, medicine, and supplies to the starving and suffering men and women and children of Afghanistan. We did not ask for this mission, but we will fulfill it.
Almost 15 years later, on July 6, 2016, President Obama addressed the American people.
We pushed al-Qaeda out of its camps, helped the Afghan people topple the Taliban, and helped them establish a democratic government. We dealt crippling blows to the al-Qaeda leadership. We delivered justice to Osama bin Laden. And we trained Afghan forces to take responsibility for their own security.
More than 5 years after that, yesterday afternoon, President Biden addressed the American people.
Here's what I believe to my core. It is wrong to order American troops to step up when Afghanistan's own armed forces would not. The political leaders of Afghanistan were unable to come together for the good of their people, unable to negotiate for the future of their country when the chips were down. They would never have done so while U.S. troops remained in Afghanistan, bearing the brunt of the fighting for them.
In two decades, the Office of the President has shifted from suggesting under President Bush that the Afghan people needed the U.S. military to save them, to claiming under President Obama that the United States military did save the Afghan people, to arguing under President Biden that the U.S. military can't be expected to save the Afghan people who don't seem to have the will or courage to save themselves. But none of these presidents expressed what I heard from former Afghan interpreter Amadullah Siddiqui when we spoke last week.
Well, first of all, these are unsung heroes, and they were so close to our American veterans. And most of the American veterans, they feel so bad for their friends, for their colleagues down in Afghanistan. We were working shoulder to shoulder with the U.S. Army. We were on a battlefield together. We had the same uniform in most of the time, and we were in fighting directly with the insurgents, with the Taliban. We were a soldier with them. Beside being an interpreter, beside being a linguist, we were a soldier. We have many instances that our interpreter saved too many American lives, our soldiers' lives. We had the same duties as the U.S. Army had, and we were the frontliner. We went to, district into district, talking to people and explaining their needs and interpreting their needs and then telling them to our soldiers. So we were the frontliner all the time.
Far from the Oval Office, the Afghan people are not helpless victims or heartless cowards. They are allies who spent two decades battling for their own nation, future, and families while incurring unimaginable costs. With me now is James Mervaldis, who is chairman of No One Left Behind and a former Army non-commissioned officer who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Melissa.
Also joining me is Kristen Rouse, board member of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. She is an Army veteran who served in Afghanistan in 2006, 2010, and 2012. Thank you for being here, Kristen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Kristen, let me begin with you. How are you doing right now, given everything that's transpired in the last few days in Afghanistan?
Well, it's been several days, I'm sure, as James can attest, not a lot of sleep, a lot of communications with folks on the ground who are just crying out for help, to not be abandoned, to not be left behind, for us to fulfill our promise of bringing them with us. We made promises to our translators saying that they can get a visa to come to the United States because they served alongside us, because they wore our uniform, because they risked their lives just as we did. and they are heroes. And we made promises.
Kristen, based on what you're saying, what do you make of President Biden's speech?
It's I take no issue with withdrawing troops. We've been told for years that there was no military solution in Afghanistan, and troops should have come home long ago. But the catastrophe that is unfolding right now, the tens of thousands of Afghans, our allies, our translators, folks who worked in government, journalists, aid workers, everyone who took part in a democratic, modern, developing Afghanistan, their lives are at risk right now. And they know it. They are being hunted down door to door by Taliban. And we have left them. We have left them, and they are desperately trying to get out. They are messaging veterans. I'm just one of countless veterans who are hearing from everyone we ever knew in Afghanistan right now. People are desperate, desperate to get out.
James, obviously this is the work that your organization has been trying to do. I know that your interpreter was one of the lucky ones who did manage to make it here to the U.S., but how long did that take?
That took 3 years, and he had a spotless case. He had a letter of a certificate of appreciation from Ambassador Cunningham at the time. He had six passed polygraph tests. When we got to year three, I reached out to Senator Tim Kaine's team and asked them as a constituent to follow up with the State Department. And they did so every 90 days until we finally got an answer. My interpreter was sitting in administrative processing for well over a year. And Melissa, just a couple points. I really appreciated you bringing up the past speeches from our presidents. And when this all happened, God, I have to go back. I think I was 17 when 9/11 happened, about to turn 17. And there's a quote in President Bush's speech that you read where he finishes the speech and says, "We will not waver, we will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail." For the last 10 years, I personally have just been trying to struggle with whether we have wavered, we have tired, we have faltered, and I think as a country we have, but I'd always hold out hope that we hadn't failed yet until Sunday. So it's heartbreaking. Veterans like Kristen are just being inundated right now. And to that point, this is hitting the veteran community in a disproportionate manner than the rest of America. Representative Ruben Gallego had a very, very insightful post that he's suffering just like all the other Afghan veterans out there, worried about their interpreters, feeling helpless. But he noted the silence he's hearing from his constituents. So this is good. This is an incredible highlight of this civilian military divide that our country is now enduring. And there are significant questions that need to be asked as we go forward.
James, I so appreciate that perspective because, you know, there's been a lot of criticism, but one of the things I feel like we haven't criticized is ourselves, right? As an American population, I mean, for you to say that you were 17 when 9/11 happened just hit me in a particular way, because the idea that we have sent our sons and our daughters and our husbands and our wives and our parents to Afghanistan for 20 years, and we seem to have taken our eyes off of what was happening there until this moment. James, is there a way that we can still rescue this sense of failure? Is there a way we can still succeed?
Yes, Melissa. We had a great success at the end of June. A family arrived. They were one of the last ones to get a visa prior to the embassy shutting down again from COVID. So they arrived in Dulles, and we took this incredible picture of a three-year-old girl who had no fear in her eyes. It's one of my favorite pictures from what we're doing. And I bring that up because that's mission accomplished. I know the White House has previously said there would be no mission accomplished moment in Afghanistan. Well, personally, just being able to bring a family over here, navigate the 14-step interagency process that had no leadership up until Ambassador Jacobson was appointed to lead it. That's the takeaway. And that's where, as veterans, we won't fail our allies. The biggest issue here now, obviously, is getting families out. No One Left Behind flew five families, about 30 people out commercially. Just for your listeners, we take exception with the president's two statements that there were SIVs that wanted to stay in Afghanistan. The reason they, to quote the president, had not exercised their right to come to America was that they were waiting to hear from the embassy about evacuation. It had not, they could not afford the $5,000 to $10,000 it cost in an airfare ticket. So we stepped in and we're paying for that. We had another 50 families scheduled to fly out this week before everything shut down.
Kristen, help our audience to understand how much danger our allies are in right now, but also how much danger they understood as they were taking on this task and the reason that the promise mattered.
Taliban are saying a lot of things right now that I hope are true, that there is an amnesty, that they are not going to harm people, and so on and so on. But we know from the last 20 plus years that the Taliban, as a characteristic, has lied. I hope they are not lying now, as they have over the last 20 years. We have seen executions in Kandahar already. I've spoken with a veteran tracking a dear friend of hers on the ground outside of Kabul, who they were internally displaced persons corralled by Taliban, and then she lost touch with them. So Taliban are tightening up checkpoints all across the country. They control all of the border crossing points. As far as I understand from the messages that I'm getting, the airport is the only way out for anybody who is identifiable as having worked for the United States. When Taliban captured all of the bases and took all of the equipment, to include equipment that the U.S. had, to include biometric technology, that includes facial recognition and retinal scans, there's a database of everyone, every Afghan who has ever worked for the United States, and they have that. And so these our allies can easily be identified if someone comes door to door or if they try to pass through any checkpoint. And so so a lot of our allies are just they are hunkering down at home. Some are desperate enough to risk their lives out at the airport. And as I messaged with one who was shot at, an interpreter who was shot at yesterday, trying to get desperately to get out. But the controlled. The controlled movement, you know, but no one can get passports right now. Nobody can get a visa right now. Banks are out of money. They can't even get cash. There are food shortages. There is a massive humanitarian crisis happening, and our allies and all Afghans are caught in this. But the ones who have targets on their heads are those who have worked for the U.S., who have worked in journalism, who have worked in aid organizations, who have worked in government. Educators have been assassinated already. This has been a continuation of what the Taliban has done over the last 20 years. This has been just an escalation of what the Taliban has been doing to Afghan leaders who have been risking their lives for the last 20 years.
Kristen Rouse, board member of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and James Mirvaldis, chairman of No One Left Behind. Thank you both for your service. And thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
The year I graduated from college, I discovered Edwige Dantica. Her 1994 novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory, gripped my Black girl becoming woman self with a tender tenacity that still has not abated nearly 30 years later. During the past month, we here at The Takeaway have reported on the assassination of Haiti's president, the precarious survival of Haiti's first lady, Saturday's devastating earthquake, and now the soaking rains of tropical depression Grace. But even as we worked to bring you these difficult stories of death and tragedy, I haven't been able to shake Dantica's voice from my own memory. Here's the award-winning author a full decade ago in 2011 during an interview with PBS.
I think When people are faced with the traumas, they are so overwhelming, and then suddenly people feel like they know, you know, they said, I've seen people at their most vulnerable, at their, you know, naked, bloody, under rubble, hungry, victims of coups. And so I think people get, you know, they get those glimpses and they feel like, I know these people. And there are those people, like the people of CNN, that we see on the CNN. And then they stop and they don't go further than that. But there's also this other Haiti, you know, that is so important to me to share. And sometimes, you know, it's as simple as the most ordinary things, you know, love, marriage, hate, conflict, you know, and beauty.
It is my distinct pleasure and my great honor to welcome National Book Award finalist, MacArthur Genius Award winner, and Haitian-American writer, Edwige Dantica, to The Takeaway. Ms. Dantica, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
Tell me about the beauty that we need to understand.
Oh, I mean, I think first we have to start with the beauty in tragedy, given this past month and given what happened this past weekend. And I was woken up like a lot of Haitian Americans, Haitian diaspora people on Saturday to the call of this earthquake. And I started thinking about the beauty of life, right? And then we started immediately seeing the images of other Haitians. You know, Haitians are always each other's first responders, and people digging in the rubble to find their neighbors, to rescue people. And then I started thinking of the wonderful, you know, that region is a very special region for me. My husband is from there. My mother-in-law has a house there and a school there. And I was thinking of the beautiful sites that also will have perished with the structures and so much. But the beauty of the people right now this morning is really what is at the center of my heart. And of course, the suffering that's been happening the last 2 days and even before that, but that is happening the last 2 days and will demand so much again of Haitian people.
How is your family that's on the ground there in the region that was most affected by the earthquake?
Well, my mother-in-law is here with us, but her, you know, the family that we have in Lekai thankfully is safe. But as you will hear from many people who have loved ones in the region, there's a lot of devastation. A lot of homes are down, and water is an urgent issue because the earthquake has stirred, you know, the water table. So streams and that people count on for clean water are muddied. Last night was a very rainy night, and people were not able to go back into the few homes that were still standing because they were either damaged or people now fear being under the concrete. So a lot of people were under tarp last night or just were seeking shelter in the most precarious circumstances. We haven't yet seen all the images, but there were some flooding. And so I think a lot of us right now are just, you know, on pins and needles in the diaspora. There's some efforts being made to try to see how we can help as a diaspora, because the Haitian diaspora is very connected at all times to the country. But we are afraid, as we were 4 years ago with Hurricane Matthew, which struck that same region and left it even more vulnerable to this event, as we were, you know, 10 years ago with the earthquake, just are really afraid for our loved ones, but also motivated to see how we can actively contribute and what we can do next.
I don't think I'll ever forget you saying just a moment ago that Haitians are always one another's first responders. Talk to me about what that means. I mean, we've talked about a decade ago, the earthquake, but I had forgotten about Matthew halfway in between all of this. What does that mean to be in diaspora where you are always first responding, you know, both in the nation and then also in diaspora to so many disasters?
Well, I think the people on the ground certainly are the immediate responders always, because, you know, that's been required of them. And it's also in the spirit of Haitian culture, this culture of la coup, which is, you know, we all live in a sort of a communal way, and this culture of combite, where sort of you today, you take care of me, tomorrow I take care of you. So, and I think that extends to the diaspora, because before, even beyond disaster response in the diaspora, you have community groups where people who come from certain regions, like we're building schools, we're, you know, clinics and so forth. So there was always that continuous connection to the diaspora that then I think goes to another, you know, level when something like this happens, because we all have family still back in Haiti, and that's you know, that sort of response extends in ordinary times, but also becomes more urgent at times like this.
So can you also think through with us as an audience a bit about how Haiti has changed across your lifetime, sort of how you experienced it as a child versus what you see now?
Well, I mean, Haiti, when I was born, was in the middle of a 30-year dictatorship. I left Haiti as a young girl at 12 years old, but I have family members who remained, like my uncle, who remained in a historic, but sometimes very marginalized area of Port-au-Prince called Bel Air. That's where I grew up and would go back. And actually that area, my uncle's place there, was destroyed in the 2010 earthquake. But I think it's very important for people to remember, as they're watching what is happening now in Haiti, sort of the history of Haiti. And I think sometimes as Haitians, we feel like we cannot stress that enough, that it was the first place in the world to abolish slavery, and then was, you know, severely punished for that. And by having to pay an indemnity to France, and then by the U.S. occupation, and all of these things that have really, and then the dictatorship that followed, that have really made it impossible to build a Haitian-led and Haitian-supported state that can really face moments like this. So I travel through that whole period, you know, from my birth to now, with a generation of people who are in the diaspora in different countries who've had to leave Haiti, me in childhood, others in adulthood. But, you know, we have, my parents always sit in my house, and it wasn't the only Haitian house in which it was said, you know, we may have left Haiti, but it has never left us.
I want to remind our listeners, and maybe you can walk us through this a bit, that when you said the first to abolish slavery, it can sound as though there was some outside force or perhaps the goodwill of enslavers that abolished it. But the punishment, the intergenerational punishment for the abolition, is because it was abolition through revolution.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, in a way, something, you know, Haiti has never been forgiven for. And, you know, how dare you, basically, you feel is being restated or remade in each event like this. And even, you know, as early as we are into this event, you have people who will say, well, you know, we have bad luck, or we can't catch a break. But there are, you know, very structural, historical, you know, colonial, imperialist reasons for all of that.
Less about luck and more about systemic inequality. Can you tell us, for those of us who are not in Haitian diaspora, but who love the nation, even from afar, the ways that either in our public discourse or in our charitable giving or just in our historical narratives, what is it that we can do to be part of and allied to Haitian recovery?
I think the most important thing is for us to try to avoid the mistakes of the 2010 inflated promises that were made, where it's often portrayed as though Haitians squandered aid that really was either never given anyway, that went back to donor countries, or that were mishandled by large organizations like the Red Cross, for example. But I think it's important for people who love and want to support Haiti at this time to give to local Haitian-led or Haitian-staffed organizations. If you have someone you know and trust in the Haitian community, ask them who they support or who they have been supporting for many, many years. And it's also important, you know, we're in this very dangerous combination in Haiti right now of being on an active and dangerous fault line that may, you know, have more people more active, that we may have more earthquakes, at the same time that we're in the crosshairs of these hurricanes that are growing more and more and intense with climate change. So it's very important that I think people who are given or people who are contributing look at organizations that are investing in long-term solutions, mm-hmm. and, you know, solutions that are, you know, taken to that, for example, work with you know, grassroots organizations in the area, the people who are going to be here long after, you know, the rescuers and others leave. So people who are trying to rebuild. And the difference between this, I think, earthquake and the one in Port-au-Prince is that here you have, this is happening in what, you know, Haitians call the pays en dehors, even though there's some very big cities in the southern region, but this is the sort of what we call the you know, in the rural area. It's less populated, which means that we had fewer casualties, but also it has people with, you know, the majority of people are working the land. They're also, this is the one of some of the greenest areas of the country that where the food production is essential in this region. So we have to, those of us who really want to help Haiti have to think about long-term solutions and supporting organizations on the ground that are doing that work, not just today, but that will doing work that helps make the country sort of just a little bit less vulnerable in this really dangerous crosshairs between hurricanes and earthquakes.
Edwige Dantica is an award-winning Haitian American writer. Thank you so much for joining The Takeaway today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Baby boomers. Born between 1946 and 1964, boomers constitute more than 20% of the total U.S. population. And since their births in the post-World War II period, they have been the engines driving trends from disposable diapers to pop culture to social protest. Now, our nation faces the challenge of caring for our elderly boomers as they age. Boomers are living longer than previous generations, but they had fewer children, and their daughters, as well as their sons, are far more likely to work full-time and to be caring for their own dependents. The model of at-home care offered by adult children is less and less possible. And the COVID-19 pandemic has exposed the depth of our nation's caregiving crisis. The cost of caregiving for many families can be overwhelming. And families are often unaware that Medicare and other government assistance only covers a fraction of the expenses involved in long-term care. And while Medicaid, the U.S. Poverty Assistance Program, does cover these costs, it also requires a person to spend down all their assets and to have less than $2,000 in order to be eligible. So let's just look at the price tag of professional caretaking. The median yearly cost of employing a home health aide full-time is around $50,000. And it's even more if we're talking about nursing homes. On top of that, professional caregivers are undervalued in the healthcare system, often facing tough working conditions, inadequate pay, and few benefits. The median hourly wage for home health and personal care aides, it's just $13 an hour. So either for financial reasons or for other reasons, more and more Americans are trying to take on that role of unpaid caregiver by themselves, finding ways to work their jobs, run their everyday lives, care for elderly family members, and it is taking a toll. We've been hearing from you about how many of you have navigated caregiving of the elders in your life and what that experience has been like for you and for your loved ones.
Hi, this is Janet, and I am calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I had to take care of my mom when she was dying of cancer. I worked full-time, had a young preschooler at the time, a single mom. So I'd hired somebody to take care of her during the day while I worked. And when I came home, I took care of her all night. I had to. And I ended up hiring somebody to take care of her, like using her savings, because, I mean, at that point, she thought she was saving it for us, but there was no need. Like, she needed to be cared for. So it was very draining, tiring. I mean, but I wouldn't have it any other way, but it was a lot. It was a lot.
Hi, my name is Ifak Holiday Reese. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada. And it is quite difficult to take care of an elderly person. In my case, I take care of my mother, who's 82 years old, and she is homebound. I find that it's very difficult even to get funding to help take care of her and various resources because the thresholds for what a person can make are so low, it makes it difficult to get financial help for the caregiver to stay home, a person like myself as well.
Hi, I'm Kim from Portland, and I've had to leave my job to care for my elderly aunt who never married or had children 24/7. And unfortunately, I had to leave a full-time, good-paying job with benefits. And now I am going to be relying on whatever the state's caregiving rate is to take care of her. And of course, I have no health insurance now. But in the meantime, this is what I'm going to do. She's my aunt. I love her. And someone has to take care of her. And unfortunately, she only has Social Security. So I'm taking on that burden.
Hi, this is Lori calling from Dallas. My mom supports my dad, and therefore I support her in this season. And it's a very difficult season. There are just very few resources for caregivers. And we live in Texas, which Medicaid, Medicare, it's the very bare minimum of resources and services that are available. My dad is bedridden, so that adds to the complications, and he's obese. So whereas one person could come in and provide services, we need additional help. I wish there was just more conversation about the burden caregivers face.
Hi, this is Becky. I'm calling from Bellingham, Washington. I took care of my octogenarian parents until their death at 90, about a year apart. I am still wracked by stress and trauma by the experience. It was easily the worst time of my life.
Now, we're going to hear from someone about their personal journey navigating the caregiving crisis during the pandemic. Lynn Hallerman is a former director of palliative care at Stony Brook University Hospital in New York and a consultant to the National Center for Equitable Care for Elders based at Harvard University. Dr. Hallerman recently wrote about her 92-year-old mother's caregiving needs for the New York Times. And here's what she told me.
She was living in what I would call supported independence with 24-hour home care, home health aid professionals. She had what would be described as a moderate dementia, which means that she had sort of her problems with short-term memory, and she had a little, you know, trouble with life's to-do list, so to speak. So I was living about an hour and a half away from my mother's and working at Stony Brook as a palliative care doctor. And my sisters, two of them, one lives in New Hampshire and one lives in Massachusetts. And so over the years, my mother had probably about 6 to 8 years of a dementia diagnosis. We had been slowly increasing the amount of help she needed, and that was usually in response to changes in her function, meaning that for a long time, she was a very robust, life-loving person. She didn't need too much help at first, but then over the years, that increased as she became more functionally dependent on her, you know, getting through her day, to the point where around the time of the pandemic in March of 2020, she had 24-hour caregivers, about five different people who were really sort of ushering her through her day and to just keep her in as much quality as possible.
And once the pandemic hits, I assume it's not just one person who's there 24 hours a day with her. It's a team of individuals over the course of a day or a week. Was it possible to continue to have that care once COVID-19 and the restrictions associated with it emerged?
We were very, very worried. You know, under conditions of, I'll say, relative stability over the years, my sister was really choreographing, having many aides in the house. I was sort of offering myself as the sort of medical piece of my mother's care. And under those conditions of stability, we could deal with it. And we had wonderful caregivers that were with her for many years. However, you know, when COVID started to emerge in New York, which happened, you know, it started in the city and we saw it sort of coming out like a wildfire, really out on Long Island where we live. I was watching, I could see Stony Brook was starting to fill up with very sick patients. We realized that we needed to make some very quick decisions about my mother. That was partially because the wonderful aides that we had They had their own lives. They had their own complications. They all commuted to take care of my mother. So they, you know, we had to consider that. They, you know, the building that my mother lived in, which she was renting in a condo, they had started to show signs of, I'll say, some panic actually around COVID. And I was not really sure. I started to worry that I'd literally lose access to my mother, or they wouldn't let the caregivers in, just out of the sort of panic that was occurring at that time. So what we ended up deciding to do was we said, you know what, let's get our mother closer to my sister in New Hampshire, very close, either to live with her or to set up an apartment, because we just thought it would all, we were watching it fall apart in New York. And just talking to my friends, and we decided to make a move. So in a very short time, I literally packed up her apartment. My sister found a place for her to stay. We found a home care agency that was willing to take my mother on. New Hampshire hadn't quite, you know, they were still didn't have numbers of cases of COVID. And my mother, we put her in the car along with, fortunately, one of her long-term aides was willing to come with us. I really don't know what we would have done if that hadn't been the case, because she knew my mother. She knew how to care for my mother. I trusted her. My mother trusted her. So we all got in the car and we sped away to New Hampshire, thinking that we were literally escaping a crisis of a caregiving crisis.
So there are kind of two parts of this story I then want to build out a little bigger. So one is we heard a lot of media and we had a lot of conversations and social media was full of, and it was, you know, sort of understood that the COVID-19 shutdown and maybe another one impending created a childcare crisis, right? Like that is the tip of everyone's tongue. You can't really talk about this past year and a half without talking about what it meant for schools to be closed and what it meant for adults, for the economy, to have children not in school and not available, and not have childcare available as well. Mm-hmm. But it did feel like elder care, like the other part of caregiving, was less talked about. I mean, we certainly talked about the effects on nursing homes, mm-hmm. but yeah. I'm wondering why our care for our elderly parents is still so invisible.
Yeah, I would say invisible is a very good word for it. I would say it's basically invisible infrastructure. I had a very unusual experience as a physician early in my training as a palliative care doctor that made me understand the work maybe a little bit more than some doctors, because I worked on an interdisciplinary hospice team. And in that context, what that really means is that every day on this inpatient unit, we had the nurse, the social worker, the chaplain, myself, and the nursing assistant. Another name for a direct care worker. We all rounded, you know, went room to room to see our patients. It's really where I learned what it meant to take care of someone, you know, do the physical care, how difficult it was. You can get injured quite easily taking care of somebody. I learned about how to feed someone properly. I learned what it really meant to turn them over carefully to look, you know, at their backsides. A lot of things that you really don't get trained as a doctor. So when the pandemic came around, I understood the partnership that is necessary between unpaid caregivers and paid care that's necessary to take care of someone who's frail. I understood that part. And in our case, we simply couldn't have done it without professional caregivers. And I'm forever grateful for that.
So my older sister has been caring for her mother, who is my godmother, throughout the pandemic. And she's now in hospice care. And we're at the end. And I was with her just 2 weeks ago and watching my sister first feed her mother. And then the big thing was lotion that day, like making sure that she had enough lotion on her arms and on her legs and that they weren't dried. And I wonder about the disservice we do by not talking about how painful and beautiful and difficult and challenging. And also just, you know, just as I watched my sister performing these acts, unpaid acts of love and care for her mother in these final weeks. It also just occurs to me, we don't even have a good framework for like the kind of leave time that my sister needs for this. Like, you know, if she were pregnant and had a baby, we would understand she needed a certain number of weeks. But there isn't a kind of social norm about the time that you need. And when, as I hear you talking about the time of the of these care teams, it feels almost like that time aspect, even more than any other aspect, is what's critical.
It's gratifying to be at the side of someone you love when they're going through something like that, but it's also incredibly strenuous. It's strenuous emotionally, physically. I would say probably one of the very hardest things I had to do as a palliative care doctor was help families navigate through a system that really doesn't make it easy. You know, so in my case, I was working with families who are literally in a caregiver crisis, meaning they had had maybe years, because oftentimes caregiving for someone with a chronic illness who is aging plays out over years, not just weeks. So the system doesn't really flex to that. So I would have to sit with families and sort of just, you know, go over what they had been doing, which was often sort of ad hoc combinations of different family members helping. And they could pull that off in what I felt was really heroic levels for very long times. But then what would happen sometimes is someone would have an incident, for instance, breaking a hip, like in the case of my mother. She broke her hip. Or when she slipped and fell off the toilet through no one's fault and broke her wrist. Things like that happen, and patients will end up in the hospital. And when it's all said and done, the amount of caregiving that they've been doing just doesn't work anymore.
It seems to me part of the story Americans like to tell about our healthcare system is that you go, you have treatment, you get better. And palliative care is, that is not what's going to happen. You're not, there's no better. There is an end, but there is a thing that is a good death. And so I'm wondering if you could help us to understand that. What is a good death?
Well, I think I just sort of go back to the story of my mother. I mean, when we brought her up to New Hampshire, we were staying in a hotel where my mother knew this hotel is where we stayed for Thanksgiving near my sister. And through no one's fault, because she was unstable, she actually wanted some chocolate ice cream, which was her favorite. She was reaching for that despite being told to wait. And she basically fell really just flat on her face. She ended up breaking her nose, breaking a bone in her neck. She had, when I found her, you know, she was with the aide, through no fault of their own. She was very unstable. You know, she was whisked off to a local hospital. I thought, this is everything I was trying to prevent from my mother when we talk about a good death. She was out of my control. She was in an ambulance. I was watching her disappear into an emergency room. I had to fight my way into the emergency room. They didn't want to let me in. I was like, please, she has dementia. You're not going to get any information from her. So we had this sort of catastrophe that was playing out as COVID was starting to ramp up in New Hampshire. Everybody was scared. Everything was closed. Through a miracle, we managed to get her out of the hospital and into an apartment that my sister had been frantically setting up while this was all playing out. I was dealing with the hospital. She was dealing with the apartment. What I had imagined a good death for my mother, it was definitely at home. We had had a long legacy in my own family of home deaths. My father died at home. My grandparents died at home. My great grandparents. So in my family, you know, lexicon, so to speak, a home death was the most important thing we were doing as a loving relative. But during COVID, we had her in an apartment. She had a hard collar around her neck for a broken neck, basically. Mm. There were no masks. We could not get masks. They had no PPE, nothing. We ended up my niece ended up sewing masks for the caregivers. They were really on their own as well. So here we were, and here they were, and we just had to pull it together on our own. You know, the agency, you know, thinking about infection control, all the things that come up, they also had their own lives. So, you know, when it comes to a good death for my mother, even though she was surviving, you know, this neck fracture that she had, I knew in my heart of hearts, just because I was a palliative care doctor, that it wouldn't take much to tip my mother into a death scenario. She was having trouble swallowing. She was having trouble eating. They couldn't get her up really from a chair. I actually had to go back to New York. I was there 7 or 8 weeks. I had to go back. So I wasn't there anymore. And she was with the professional aide, you know, and a series from the agency. You know, the night my mom died, it was the middle of the night. I got a phone call. I could hear what was going on the other end. It was the aide that knew her well that was really with her. And my mother had been taken to the bathroom. She collapsed on the floor. The aide was with her on the floor, holding her hand, and put a pillow under her head. We called 911 because she couldn't get her up off the floor. And the paramedics were some of the nicest, kindest on the phone. I could hear them. They lifted my mother into bed. The caregiver that she knew forever was by her side. My sister was on her way, and my mother died. And however hard that was for me not to be there, I knew, because I had somebody that really knew what they were doing, who I had had a partnership with a number of years, a professional, and it's given me incredible peace and comfort to know that. So for our family, that's what happened during COVID. But I would say, you know, it was a so-called good death. I don't think that's been the case for everybody, however, during COVID. I think that many people have had similar experiences to our family, but, you know, weren't able to get their loved one back home and found them sort of disappearing into the system and not having access, which I think would be very difficult for them.
Dr. Lynn Hallerman is a consultant to the National Center for Equitable Care for Elders, based at Harvard University. Dr. Hallerman, thank you for sharing your personal and your professional story with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Hi, I'm calling from Madison, and my grandmother needed to come live with us when I was in high school. My mom had been recently diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had to care for her mom, move her out of the house, close up the house, and my grandmother came to live with us. It was a very important time for us. We got to know her much better, and she blossomed while she was with us. And I don't know how my parents took care of all that while my mom was also dealing with a new diagnosis. They were so strong, I don't know how they did it.
My name is Tom Shelley, calling from Shorewood, Minnesota, regarding navigating caregiving of older people. My response was yes, just for the last 4 weeks of my mom's life while she was in hospice for cancer. Main lesson learned was how important it is for a person in institutional care to have an outside advocate to look out for their interests.
Hi, my name is Catherine. I'm calling from San Diego. It's a full-time job to do caregiving. Luckily, I was retired. And it's not like children that grow up and need less. Aging parents need more and more.
Hi, this is Linda Aldridge. I'm calling from Concord, California. When my parents were no longer capable of caring for themselves, they moved from Pennsylvania to California, here where I live. And I moved from a home I loved to a larger home where I and my partners could care for my parents. That was 7 years ago. My mother has since died. My father is still with us and looks like he will be for some time. I am grateful to be able to care for him, but the long-term effect of living with a parent, of having the daily friction on childhood wounds, is hard and wearing in ways I did not imagine. I struggle with depression and despair. There are gains in the situation, but oh, there are also so many losses.
Hello, this is Nancy from Omaha. I was my family's dying process caretaker for a generation. My daughter has taken up that now. A family member died last month. She was in her 80s. Got to die where she wanted to spend her last days, at the home of the grandson she had raised and his family. Taken on outings to the ocean and mountains she loved. And when she survived COVID, to a blues bar to dance in her wheelchair. When she was done with life, she left us. Aside from missing her, I'm not sad about her passing. I've been a support at the end of enough lives that I do not fear death. I fear for those dying alone, feeling forgotten, or held prisoner in bodies on machines, not allowed to die because others can't bear to let them go. I watch a granddaughter be a support for her terminally ill grandfather, and I am ambivalent. It's such a hard, precious role. I try to teach her to take care of herself, put her on her own oxygen mask first, then continue doing what she can to assist others. Thank you for asking.
Y'all, I know this has been a heavy show, but we made it through together, and I always appreciate spending a little time with you. Now, before we go, I wanted to send you off with something a little more fun. Last week, I shared with you some of the sounds from my life, and I asked you to do the same. Well, the team here at The Takeaway got pretty excited about this project, and they wanted in on the fun, too. So the first one up.
Hi, I'm Katarina Barton, and I'm a producer on The Takeaway.
What you need to know about Katarina? She lives in Brooklyn. She has two roommates who work in the restaurant industry, and apparently they have some very musical dinners.
The moon meets her eye like a big pizza pie.
So we're making pasta, family dinner, with my roommates. A penne vodka without vodka.
No, it has vodka. It comes with vodka, like me.
Mozzarella, some Parmesan. It's just kind of a whole spiel.
Lots of pasta.
All right, folks, it's your turn. What does your life sound like? Give us a tiny slice of you. Take out your phone or any other recording device and just catch a snippet. Tell us who you are and what we're hearing, and email your audio to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Keep it relatively concise. We're not producing your own reality show here, okay? Just a glimpse of what your life sounds like. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.